Hello, and welcome to our program this evening, Strangers and Sojourners, the Jews of Boston, with Professor Ellen Smith. My name is Sarah Quiet, and I am the programming and outreach manager of the Weiner Family Jewish Heritage Center at American Ancestors. I will be your moderator today. The Jewish Heritage Center is a research and educational center dedicated to preserving New England Jewish history, exploring Jewish heritage, and illuminating the American Jewish experience for wide audiences. We are located in Boston at American Ancestors, America's founding genealogical organization and a national center for family history, heritage, and culture. Today, we are pleased to welcome Ellen Smith and to gain new insights about Jewish history from her. As we mark 30 years since the publication of the vitally important book, The Jews of Boston, and 250 years since the American Revolution, we want to revisit the topic of one of Ellen's chapters in The Jews of Boston, titled Strangers and Sojourners, The Jews of Colonial Boston. Before we get started, I want to make a few housekeeping notes about this webinar. You in the audience will be muted throughout. If you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the Q&A panel at the bottom of your screen, and we will try to answer as many as we can following Ellen's presentation. Also, as we are broadcasting from different locations, we ask you to bear with us if we experience any technological issues. No matter what, we will send you a link to the full recording of this session to watch and share later. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. A scholar of American Jewish history, Ellen Smith is Professor Emerita of Brandeis University, where she is director of the Hornstein Jewish, excuse me, where she was director of the Hornstein Jewish Professional Leadership Program and taught courses in American Jewish history, museum studies, and visual and material culture. Trained as both a museum curator and historian, she is the author or curator of over 30 books, catalogs, and museum exhibitions on Jewish history and culture. She is the author and co-editor of The Jews of Boston with Dr. Jonathan Sarna, curator of three exhibitions on Boston Jewish history, and chief historian for the Emmy Award-winning WGBH television production, The Jews of Boston. Without further ado, welcome Ellen Smith.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so thrilled with that there's still excitement of something 30 years old, and I'm delighted to be able to rethink and revisit some of this with all of you tonight. I'm just going to start right away in the beginnings of American Jewish history, because from its beginnings, the overall American Jewish experience is different from anything in the history of European Jewish communities that preceded it. American Jewish history is diverse. It includes a variety of Jewish people and practices from the beginning. There is never just one way of being Jewish in America. It's voluntary. You can choose any way you want to be Jewish. There was never a chief rabbi in America. Indeed, in the colonial period, there wasn't even one rabbi. Individuals could be as observant or as unobservant as they choose, and can even walk away from Judaism without penalty. That factor of voluntary choice makes American Judaism distinctive from its earliest days in this hemisphere. It's experimental because it is voluntary and because it is definitely a minority culture. American Jewish life is constantly undergoing examination, change, and adaptation. Significantly, it's also influenced by women. Also, uniquely versus other ethnic and religious groups, Jewish women migrate to America in almost the same numbers as men. So, American Jewish history generally starts early in the 17th and early 18th centuries in towns along the British colonial eastern seaboard, including New York, Newport, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Savannah. But in Boston, none of this happened until almost 2 centuries after the first Jews arrived in the North American British colonies. So tonight we're going to spend our entire time talking about something that never happened, Boston colonial Jewish history, and yet why early Boston Jewish history is so important and what we can learn from it that's relevant even today. Solomon Franco may have been Boston's first Jew. He is certainly the first Jew of record, though it's a problematic record. Franco was on a ship that sailed from Holland and docked in Boston Harbor in April of 1649 with a cargo that was intended for a Boston militia officer. But confusion arose over who Franco owed Franco his pay, and the local court concluded that it was not the local officer. Franklin was left stranded in Boston, angry and broke. Not being a citizen of Boston, Franco was labeled a stranger, a legal term. Because he could not support himself, he was warned out of town. But the court, recognizing that he had no income, voted to give him 6 shillings a week for 10 weeks from the town treasury until he could book passage to Holland. 3 months after his arrival, Boston's first Jew of record sailed away. Roland Gideon first appears in town records in 1674, identified as the Jew. He typifies so many of the Jews of the early Americas. His ancestors were Portuguese conversos whose wanderings took them from Lisbon to Brazil to Amsterdam to Hamburg, where Gideon was born. He then went on to Barbados or Jamaica and finally Boston, where in 1674 he shows up in a town court record as he and his business partner sued to recover £100 debt. The verdict in the case doesn't survive, but an extraordinary petition from Gideon to the court does. He wrote, "I commend my case to the honored court and gentlemen of the jury. God command our fathers that the same law should be for the stranger and the sojourner as for the Israelites." Franco and Gideon, one a sojourner and one a resident stranger, the language is from Abraham in Genesis. Both understood that as Jews, they had little legal standing in British North America. And yet both had the courage to pursue their rights in public. This is the role Jews, as a tiny minority in America throughout this country's history, would continue to play. So, what happens in Boston where there are no or very few real Jews? How are Jews understood by those with no contact with them? Boston's early Puritan history gives us one set of insights into outsiders' views of Jews and how such understandings are incorporated into American life. Now, American Puritans often get a bad rap, but I love them. I've spent my entire academic career studying and writing about them, not least in their relationship to Jews. From the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century and even before, the movement to understand the Hebrew Bible in its own language brought European scholars and ministers into the orbit of Hebrew language, Jewish texts, and Jewish individuals. Greatly oversimplifying, their motives were two: to understand biblical Hebrew so that they could understand their Old Testament in its original language, and to have the language and education to help them bring around the conversion of the Jewish nation, which they felt was a required precursor to the day of the Lord or the second coming of Christ. Puritans also modeled their laws, their communities, and their pieties on the Hebrew Bible. In Boston, the version of laws passed in 1641, the famous Body of Liberties, was based on a set of laws drafted in 1636 by the Reverend John Cotton, the model of Moses, his judicials. Many Protestants, including those who settled New England, understood themselves of new, as a new Israel. And what you're looking at is the Book of Psalms, the base psalm book, published in 1640 in Boston with type cut for the volume. It was made to be sung. The Puritans and the Protestants sang the Book of Psalms regularly, and it's written in a meter to be sung. So, for example, the famous 23rd Psalm reads in this version, "The Lord to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall not I," and on it goes. The other thing you're looking at is William Bradford's Hebrew Exercises, the end page of his diary of his journal of Plymouth Plantation. At the very end of his life, William Bradford practiced the Hebrew grammar, transcribed Hebrew text, and here he writes his motive for doing so, so that he can speak to God and the angels in the language that God and the angels speak. In Boston, absent a permanent Jewish community of Jews, the focus on Hebrew language and text was intense among the Puritan clergy and the scholars of Harvard College. This focus was especially high among the city's premier 17th century ministerial family, the Mathers. We've just seen the Bay Psalm Book, a key work of one of Boston's founding ministers, Richard Mather. His son, the Reverend Increase Mather, wrote extensively of the conversion of the Jewish nation, and his book, The Mystery of Israel's Salvation, was the most influential book on the subject for over a century. Increase's son, Cotton Mather, perhaps the most prolific author America ever produced, also spent enormous time identifying Jewish travelers through Boston or the rare Jew who stayed for a while in his efforts to convert them to Christianity. The diaries of both Samuel Sewall and Cotton Mather remember Cotton's endless and fruitless efforts to convert three Frazon brothers, Joseph, Samuel, and Moses, who for a time ran a warehouse in Boston Harbor. Today, we'll focus closely on the lives of two individuals who lived in Boston in the 18th century, and through their lived realities, see the options and opportunities people had as Jews in this very new world. We'll examine the Jewish life and journeys of Judah Monis and Moses Michael Hayes, whose very different pathways provide a pair of compelling tales of how Jews in early America shaped their Jewish lives and in many ways mirror the choices Americans have in America today. We'll start in the 1720s, where into the Jewish vacuum of Protestant New England came the Jewish scholar and Hebraicist Judah Monis. His earliest years remain obscure. He was likely born in Italy in 1683 and was descended, as were so many early American Jews, from a family of Portuguese conversos. Educated at the Jewish academies in Leghorn, Italy, and in Amsterdam, Holland, Moses emigrated to British North America. By 1715, Moses had settled in New York City, where he was running a small store and teaching Hebrew to Christians and Jews. But by 1720, he had moved again, this time to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to be near some of the Puritan ministers with whom he had been corresponding about the Jewish language, Kabbalah, and the Hebrew scriptures. Friends who considered Monis a great master of the Hebrew language urged him to apply for a position at Harvard College, and on April 30th, 1722, the corporation voted that Mr. Judah Monis be improved as an instructor of the Hebrew language in the college. Moses replaced the tutors in that role and became Harvard College's first instructor in Hebrew. Harvard College was founded in 1636 to ensure that an educated and literate Protestant ministry would be raised up for the future. Harvard students were required to have a command of a number of biblical and pre-biblical Semitic languages. By the 1720s, when Monis assumed his position, the curriculum required 4 days a week of Hebrew instruction for all its students except freshmen. While demonstrated competence in Greek and Latin were entrance requirements to Harvard in those years, and some boys entered as early as 15, Hebrew would have been new to them. Each student was required to have a Hebrew Bible or Psalter, a Hebrew lexicon. Instruction consisted of small compositions each week, copying the grammar and reading it, reciting and reading, construing and parsing, translating, composing, and reading without vowels. The main textbook for all this was one written by Monis himself. When he first proposed to the college that he become their Hebrew instructor, he showed them a manuscript copy of a Hebrew grammar book he had composed. It was surely one of the strong points supporting his hire. Students had to copy the manuscripts and many of their other textbooks painstakingly by hand. Jonathan Belcher indicated on his copy of Monis's manuscript, now in the Massachusetts Historical Society, that it took about 4 weeks to transcribe. Think of him doing it in dark New England winters by candlelight in a drafty Harvard dorm. That situation was remedied in 1735 when Monis's Grammar of the Hebrew Tongue was published on the Cambridge Press with Hebrew type sent from London. 1,000 copies of the book were printed, and for the next 25 years, the book was a required text for all Harvard students. Hebrew was taught much the way we learn it now, beginning with the alphabet, small words and phrases, and eventually through longer text groupings. Payments for the book were automatically added to the students' family quarterly bills. You bought it whether you wanted it or not. And apparently, not every student wanted it. Students from the 17th century on complained that Hebrew exercises and grammar were boring. And Monus may have been a fine scholar, but he had a decidedly mixed reputation as a teacher. Surviving copies of Moses's students' manuscripts are full of doodles and marginal insults directed at their instructor. College records show that Monus was frequently hazed and that attendance in his class was a constant problem. The college recorded itself greatly satisfied with his instruction in 1723, but by 1724, the college returned the teaching of undergraduates to the tutors, and Moses taught only graduate students and the college tutors themselves. Well, this is all kind of an amazing story, but there was a catch to all these firsts. Harvard at the time required that its faculty be Christian. One more month before he assumed his post at Harvard, in a very public ceremony, Judah Monus converted to Christianity. Monus's baptism and conversion garnered worldwide attention. Many ministers were skeptical of the sincerity of the conversion, but the Reverend Benjamin Coleman, who delivered the sermon at Moses's conversion ceremony, wrote, "There is no cause to fear that Mr. Monus will renounce his Christianity, since he did embrace it voluntarily and gradually, and with much consideration from scriptures in the Old Testament." Many who know this history conclude that Monus converted to Christianity to secure his job at Harvard, that he converted for convenience rather than from conviction. I see this differently. Moses had been raised and educated in strong Jewish communities in Europe and had spent his early American years in the established Jewish community of New York City. His deep and ongoing study of Torah and Kabbalah brought him into correspondence and conversation with the most learned Hebraicists on the continent at the time, the faculty and fellows of Harvard College. He started to read the Hebrew scriptures as Christians read them, as prefiguring and predicting Jesus as the Messiah, the Christ. I take Monus at his word that he converted after careful study and consideration. Why do I think so? Monus didn't just take the job and continue quietly. Shortly after his conversion, Monus published a series of three books in Boston addressed to the Jews of Europe that intended to convince them not only of his sincerity of his conversion, but potentially to convince them to convert themselves. The books are titled The Truth, The Whole Truth, and yes, Nothing But the Truth. And they begin by acknowledging to his intended Jewish readers in one of my favorite lines in all of Jewish literature, addressed to the Jews of Europe, "The news of my embracing the Christian religion will likely not be the best you have ever heard." Then he goes on to say, "I did it not rashly, but upon mature thoughts and deliberations." The books then sought to prove that the Jewish scriptures foretold Jesus as the Messiah, argued for the divinity of Jesus, and sought to prove the doctrine of the Trinity. Other evidence supports the sincerity of Monus's conversion. The final pages of his Grammar of the Hebrew Tongue include Hebrew translations of the Creed and the Lord's Prayer. That's not for the Harvard students. They knew that stuff by heart. The document is to make those confessions accessible to European Jews via the Hebrew language. And projects he worked on all his life but never finished for publication included an English Hebrew lexicon and a translation into Hebrew of the key documents of the Protestant faith so that they would be accessible to Jews. There's behavioral evidence of the sincerity of his conversion as well. He joined the First Church in Cambridge and remained a lifelong member and supporter. His marriage to Abigail Merritt, a Christian woman, seems to have given them both comfort, and they conducted their public lives well integrated into the Christian Jewish community and well regarded by it. He died in 1764 and is buried in the Christian Cemetery in Northborough, Massachusetts, where he had moved after his wife's death and his retirement in 1760. He donated three silver communion cups to that church, was voted a seat of honor, and eventually left a bequest to establish a fund for ministers' widows, a fund that survived well into the 20th century. Judah Monus entered deeply into the life of Harvard and Cambridge in another way as well. He acquired at least two enslaved people. In 2022, after an intensive 3-year project in which Harvard faculty, students, and staff researched Harvard's long history of direct ties to slavery, the university released its report of the President's Committee on Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery. It found that Harvard leaders, faculty, and staff enslaved more than 70 people during the 17th and 18th century. On that list, and not a new discovery, was Judah Monus, noted in the church and town records as having two enslaved people in his household, Cuffy and Cicely. At one point, Cicely was betrothed to Juba, a quote, Negro servant of President Holyoke of Harvard. That marriage never took place, and later records indicate the marriage of Cicely and Cuffy, who had been baptized in Cambridge's first church in 1741. The mention of my Negro child Mariah in Monus's will is likely the child of Cicely and Cuffy. Monus's life presents one example, if an extreme example, of how Jewish individual made him place for himself in colonial America. Without the support of Jewish institutions, a Jewish community, or even other Jewish individuals, Monus entered the life of Cambridge as a Christian. He consciously chose to do so. Having left a voluntarily left a mature Jewish community in New York City, Monus came to te Cambridge to teach the Hebrew tongue as a Christian. He seems never to have looked back. But Monus's community sometimes looked on him with caution, and perhaps as an ambiguous Christian. The Cambridge First Church, contemporary diaries, and the college records often refer to Monus as the converted Jew, the converted rabbi, the Christianized Jew. Church records indicate concern that Monus may have continued observing the Sabbath on Saturdays. And the headstone over his grave bears witness to the double identity by which Monus was understood by his Christian community. The inscription reproduces, in part, a phrase from the New Testament book of Romans, chapter 11. A native branch of Jacob's seed, which once from off its olive broke, regrafted from the living tree. Moses Michael Hayes chose a very different approach to being a Bostonian and a Jew. Like Monus, he lived in a city with no Jewish community and very few Jewish residents. Most of them who did flit through were impermanent traders. Yet Hayes and his family lived their lives publicly as Jews, ultimately honored and remembered for it. Hayes was born in New York City in 1739. His parents were Dutch immigrants who had arrived in New York City around 1720. Moses, raised by his father to be a shopkeeper and a trader, inherited the business when his father died in 1764. His parents also raised Moses with a firm grounding in his Jewish faith and responsibilities. As a member of New York's congregation Shiraz Israel, Moses eventually served as its second Parnas and Parnas, its vice president and president. In 1766, Moses married Rachel Myers, the younger sister of famed New York silversmith Meyer Myers. By 1769, they had moved to Newport, where Moses partnered in a trading business, but because of various losses at sea and other inevitable misfortunes, his business became insolvent, and Hayes and his partner were jailed. They were released in 1771, and by 1772, he was again selling the full range of transatlantic wares. But he and his family abandoned Newport ahead of the British attack in 1776, living at least part-time in Boston. By 1782, they were living there full-time. Post-revolution Boston was a devastated town. For the next 3 decades, Hayes and his family would play key roles in establishing the financial and cultural institutions that would come to define post-revolutionary and 19th-century Boston. Hayes opened a shipping office and a warehouse on Long Wharf. His office was in the heart of Boston, in the American Cafe building on State Street, and the picture you're looking at about halfway down on the right is where his office would be down, right down from the State House. Hayes's list of accomplishments is almost jaw-dropping. He was among the first Boston merchant to enter the newly opened trading markets in the Far East. That trade required a new kind of financing, and Hayes was one of the original 9 founders and stockholders of the Massachusetts Bank, chartered in 1784. Located on what is now Tremont Street, it was the first independent joint stock bank in the United States and the second bank chartered in Massachusetts, later the Bank of Boston, which was eventually absorbed by Bank of America. Hayes was the Massachusetts Bank first depositor of record and the first to withdraw money. Indeed, he seems to have been in and out of the bank several times a day. The only time I have ever seen anything in print written against this man was on a check that he deposited. He must have been driving them crazy because the teller wrote, quinnook in it, which means in English busybody, or in Yiddish probably means nudnik. Trade with the Far East posed new financial and physical risks, and Hayes also took the lead in founding the earliest marine and fire insurance companies in Boston. Hayes contributed to a huge list of civic projects, from beautifying Boston Common to building bridges and turnpikes, theaters and banks, and supporting Harvard College. He was also instrumental in introducing the Masonic movement in New England and rose to its highest ranks. The Masonic Lodge of Boston, formerly on Tremont Street and now in Newton, carries his name to this day. In New York and Newport, Hayes had led Masonic lodges with significant Jewish membership. In Boston, he joined as the only Jew. It was the first signal that Hayes would be accepted in Boston for the entirety of who he was. Hayes' extensive good works brought him in contact with friends in what was described at the time as the first circles of society. Among his closest friends was Paul Revere. Hayes sponsored Revere to serve as his deputy during Hayes's second term as Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Masons. And Hayes also commissioned at least 9 pieces of silver that Paul Revere made for him and his family. The Hayes family lived on Middle, now Hanover Street, and I'm quoting, one of the fashionable streets in town. It was a large brick home with 15 rooms and 31 windows. The family filled it to capacity. Moses and Rachel had 7 children, 6 of whom survived infancy. In 1784, Moses's sister Raina Touro, the widow of Rabbi Isaac Touro of Newport, came to live in the house with her 3 children, Abraham, Judah, and Rebecca Touro. When Raina died 3 years later, Moses assumed full responsibility for the 3 Touro children. The 1790 Record Commissioners of Boston recorded that the Hayes household was made up of 2 white males, 2 white males under 16, 11 females, 2 other free persons, and no slaves. Others described the heartbeat of the household. Under Hayes's roof dwelt hospitality. It was an asylum for friendship, a mansion of peace. Samuel Joseph May, Louisa May Alcott's grandfather, recorded his memories of the family in his autobiography. May had been a childhood friend of the Hayes and Touro children and had lived with them for weeks at a time, and he remembered the household this way. He wrote about the feasts that the family gave. I am pretty sure he's talking about weekly Shabbat dinners. And what he says is that at the end of those meals, they would go to the back porch and distribute the leftovers to the poor. And May writes, not only the crumbs, but the ampler portions as well. And so May wrote, of course, I grew up without prejudice against Jews or any other religionists because they did not believe as my father and my mother believed. Moses and Rachel raised their children's nephews and niece as practicing Jews. They conducted regular worship services in their home. The household library contained dozens of Hebrew books. The Jewish obligation to practice charity guided much of their public work on behalf of the Boston citizens. When Hayes died in May of 1805, on his 66th birthday, Moses was eulogized up and down the East Coast. Obituaries spoke of the esteem and affection with which Boston society held him. He was remembered as a man of strong intellect, virtue, and benevolence, as a kind husband, an indulgent father, and a most valuable citizen. But he was not a typical citizen. The man who helped create modern Boston was a part of its highest ranks, who also was recognized as a man apart. The obituaries acknowledged that difference and bridged it in his death as Hayes had bridged it in his life. Quoting from these obituaries, take him for all in all, he was indeed a man, they wrote in Boston and Newport. He is now secure in the bosom of his father and our father, of his God and our God. Moses Michael Hayes set a standard in late 18th century Boston for business and civic leadership, community service, and charity. The most prominent Jew in Boston before the 1840s, he achieved what many before him could not, success as both a Bostonian and a Jew. Without the benefit of an organized Jewish community and without legal guarantees of religious freedom, Hayes was able to preserve his religious heritage and pass it on to his family as a living faith. Hayes's only son, Judah, grew to join his father in his insurance, shipping, and civic enterprises, including as one of the original proprietors of the Boston Athenaeum. Judah was likely the first Jew to hold elective office in the city in the position of fire ward. Judah drowned off the coast of Florida in 1832, and the Hayes name associated with his father and grandfather died with him. The Hayes daughters also advanced the Hayes enterprises. Daughters Judith and Sarah each married a Myers first cousin and all moved to Richmond, Virginia. Daughters Catherine and Sloe never married and followed their sisters south. They are buried under a single headstone in the Newport Jewish Cemetery. Daughter Rebecca died in Boston at age 32, unmarried. But the Hayes family endures in additional ways. In 1822 in Richmond, Virginia, Judith Hayes Myers' son Gustavus fathered a child with Nellie Forrester, a free woman of color. The Forrester descendants are also direct descendants of Moses Michael Hayes. The eighth generation of Forresters produced Keith Stokes, a contemporary Newport resident, Rhode Island and family historian, Newport civic leader, and husband of Teresa Guzman Stokes, a direct descendant of a prominent Spanish Jewish Sephardic family. The Stokes website, Eyes of Glory, documents in detail the independent and intertwined history of early American Ashkenazic Jews, Blacks, and Sephardic Jews. That too is an American story and part of Boston's Jewish history. Abraham and Judah Turow each deserve full lectures in their own right. When we remember their huge contributions to the upbuilding of Boston, New Orleans, and American Jewish communities, we should remember that they were raised in large measure by Moses and Rachel Hayes in the heart of Boston. To give just a taste of their accomplishments, Abraham Turow spent his life in Boston and Medford, living with his sister Rebecca. Abraham served as a Boston agent for his brother Judah and conducted shipping with the West Indies, building vessels in his Medford shipyard. He spearheaded the 1816 fundraising drive for the then failing Massachusetts General Hospital, which he remembered in his will for $10,000, a sum that, quoting, fairly took the breath away of the MGH leadership. Abraham died in 1822 after he was thrown from his chaise. His bequest preserved the Newport Touro Synagogue, the cemetery, and the street leading up to it. Remembered Congregation Sheareth Israel in New York and supported civic organizations in Boston and New York. Touro streets in Newport and Medford still bear his name. He is buried in Newport's Jewish cemetery. And on your slide, notice that the way you arrived at Mass General in 1816 was by boat. Judah Turow sailed from New Orleans for New Orleans in 1801 and remained there the rest of his life, initially running a small trading venture that propelled him into enormous wealth when the United States acquired the city in 1803. Nearly killed in 815 in the Battle of New Orleans, he was rescued by his friend Rezin Shepherd and spent the rest of his days in Rezin's household. Turow, who was staunchly opposed to slavery, insisted that the enslaved people in the Rezin household be freed. Rezin Shepherd did so. Turow also purchased slaves at auction and then set them free. Turow lived quietly and frugally out of all limelight and by strict economy amassed a true fortune. In his lifetime, he supported the rebuilding and upbuilding of New Orleans and paid for the construction of half the Bunker Hill Monument in Boston. He died in 1854 at age 78, remembered, as were his father and his uncle, as a man who was born, reared, and had lived and died in the Hebrew faith. The Touro Infirmary and Touro Street in New Orleans bear his name. His extraordinary will of $400,000 bequeathed over half of it to every Jewish organization he knew of in the United States and some in Palestine. Boston individuals and organizations, Jewish and secular, were especially favored. He too is buried in the Newport Jewish Cemetery. So Judah Monis and Moses Michael Hayes represent the extremes of choices Jews could make and can make in America. Monis, who spent his early life immersed in Jewish community and Jewish learning, chose to leave that milieu and entered full face and full force into the Christian community of Harvard and Cambridge. He joined other Harvard and Cambridge faculty, ministers, and leaders by enslaving two people. In British colonial America, these choices of faith and custom were his to make. He could make those choices voluntarily, knowing he could live his chosen life without punishment or persecution or pressure. Moses Michael Hayes chose differently. In a Boston community he helped to rebuild, but a community in which he and his family were solo Jews, they lived publicly and proudly as Jews. And there it is. America as a place of experiment and choice for Jews. Some, like Judah Monis, would be absorbed entirely. Others, like Moses Michael Hayes, would carve roles for themselves as Americans and as Jews. But all would benefit from a land that gave them opportunities to choose, to commit, or to change, even as they abided as alien residents without the guarantee of religious freedom. Boston's colonial Jewish history, scanty though it is thus an enduring case study of what it means to be a minority faith and in a nation overwhelmingly comprised of other faiths and peoples. Similar choices remain ours today. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ellen, for that excellent presentation. Now, let's turn to the audience's questions. As a reminder, you can submit your questions by clicking on the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. I'd like to start with a first question that I see here from Elliot. How were the colonial Jews able to congregate and have a minyan in Boston?
Oh, they didn't. Without question, they did not. The Hayes household had some. They had father, son, and two nephews, but that's what they had. And there certainly was no synagogue. But a Torah is portable, and they had a Torah, and prayer books are portable, and they had that. One of the exhibitions I did, we were able to borrow quite a few books from the Hayes original library, and they would have had all of the implements that they would have needed to conduct household services, and you are certainly allowed to pray even if you don't have a minyan.
Thank you. I see another question. I see many questions actually that are very interesting. So, we'll need to decide where to go next. The next I think I want to ask, which I'm also curious about. I don't know if you have the answer, but Janet is curious about the significance of the skull and crossbones on Judah Monis's gravestone.
Yes, that's a Puritan emblem. There's a language of tombstones in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Jewish cemeteries have their own language. If you go in Boston to the Ohavai Shalom original earliest 1844 cemetery out in East Boston, and you walk around, you can take a guide with you to try to translate all the different emblems that mean something in the Jewish cemetery. Skull and crossbones is very common in Protestant cemeteries, and it reminds you, memento mori, that everybody is mortal. Everybody will die. Everybody will return to dust and bone. And those are emblems and warnings, but also invitations to people who come to visit to live life well while you are alive. And certainly in the Protestant religion, to prepare yourselves for the next world.
Thank you. That is really interesting. Next, I have a question from Julie. Was there a sense from any of these personal records that the question of religious freedom was something that was on their minds?
Oh, yes, of course. Very aware of it. So, we saw that Roland Gideon, an absolute nobody, petitioned a court both to reimburse him for the debt owed to him, but also to remind them that he, as a Jew, as a human being, as a sojourner and a stranger, was entitled to the equal justice that anybody else in Boston could get. That's a pretty gutsy thing to have done, I will say. Where there are very few records of Jews in Boston in courts, they all seem to get fair treatment. And part of that, I would argue, can't prove it, but comes out of The 17th century focus on Jewish law as the basis for Massachusetts law. That doesn't survive into the 18th century, but the early founding ministers are working intensively with Leviticus and Deuteronomy to try to construct what a biblical culture looks like. And so one of the things that attracts Puritan and Jewish readers to those books is the constant thumping that there is equal justice for the stranger, the alien, and the Israelite. And that is an undercurrent in those early Puritan laws.
I have a few questions about the availability of kosher meat and when that began in Boston.
Right, not available. Not available unless they were slaughtering their own meat. Now, the experience of Jews in New York is very different, and that's a different chit chat. But there is a family about the same time that Monis is in Boston, the Abigail Levy Franks family. And Abigail Levy is very famous for a correspondence she had with her son Naftali, who they had sent to England to work with the father's brothers. And Abigail is a really interesting case because she's very torn between her love of British culture. I mean, she has her son send her the most recent Enlightenment books and she devours them. And at the same time, she's very worried about how are they going to stay Jewish. And one of the things she is constantly urging on Naftali is eat kosher food. Don't eat at Uncle So-and-so's house because it's not kosher. She wants this Jewish continuity, and yet she's torn about how to get it. Real quickly, one of her daughters is being courted by the young Jewish gentlemen, plural, in New York, and she hates all of them. And she writes to Naftali and just says, one of them comes and she says, I wouldn't allow her to date him if he came in a horse with six, a carriage and six horses. And so, fine. The young daughter eventually does get married. She goes off and elopes with a Christian, the son of Abigail's best friend, and Abigail is having a complete breakdown about that. So it's not easy. In Boston, it doesn't come up because it doesn't come up. But in New York, where you have those options, it isn't easy either.
You mentioned courting in this last answer, and we have a question that I'm looking to pull up that was specifically about one of the participants noticed that there were a number of Jewish women who didn't marry. I see it was from Sandy, and the question was about, is it related to the scarcity of Jewish men in Boston?
Again, there are no Jewish men in Boston. There are no Jews in Boston. But you look at what happens say, to the Hayes daughters. They go down to Richmond, Virginia, and two of them marry first cousins. If there are intensive genealogies of these early Jewish families, a lot of them marry their first cousins. A lot of them have the same name. You have to be strong of heart to dig into these genealogies. But if you don't marry your first cousin, these are still very small communities. So when we say there's a Jewish community in Richmond, or we say there's a Jewish community somewhere, we're talking dozens, not hundreds. And so it's very difficult. There's folklore around a couple of those daughters. One is that Catherine, who didn't marry, and Judah Turow fell in love, and that was prohibited by the Hayes family, hence Judah Turow's departure for New Orleans. No way of knowing if that's true or not, but that is folklore that has descended over many generations. To follow that story through, when I was curator at the American Jewish Historical Society, we had a very large collection of portraits of Jewish men and women, some of them done by the most famous portrait artists in America. And they're all the ones we had were done before 1820. So we thought, well, this will be great. Let's do an exhibition of these. We eventually did. It was at the Jewish Museum in New York. But in doing the research, we ended up in the South, a lot of time in South Carolina, a lot of time in Georgia, visiting families that were now Christian. None of these families that went south stayed Jewish, but there were members of all of those families who knew their genealogy and they knew who was Jewish. And they had the picture of some Jewish ancestor, in their parlor. By the time we were done, we had identified over 500 portraits and miniatures of Jews in America before 1820. And that data is now all available on a database through the American Jewish Historical Society. It was a stunning number, but they aren't Jewish. The descendants of Abigail Franks are not Jewish. So, how do Jews continue in America? Immigration, immigration, immigration.
We have a question from Diana about social class and if there are any known 18th century Jews in less than educated, enterprising upper class.
Yeah, probably those three Frazon brothers down on the wharf, that Cotton Mather is chasing eternally. They're kind of ghosty Jews that run around in Boston. I didn't talk, but in the 1760s, there were two that came up from New York as factors, i.e., company representatives for a New York firm that made snuff. That was very popular. And that went the way of all partnerships. They fought, they broke up. One went here, one went there. But while they were here, very interestingly, there is documented evidence that they bought a plot for a Jewish cemetery so that if somebody was Jewish and died in Boston, probably worried about themselves, there would be sanctified Jewish ground for them to be buried in. The location of that is on what's now Lynn Street behind what used to be. Behind the Harrison Gray Otis house that he built, the Bullfinch built for Harrison Gray Otis, behind historic New England, which used to be the, New England Historic Genealogical Society. It's now a parking lot. And the plot on the deed, which exists into the 1760s, is set aside as a burial ground for the Israelitish nation. And it looks like it's big enough to maybe bury two or three people. Over the years, people have said, well, we'll dig it up and find out. I don't know about that. I don't think anybody was ever buried there. But it's that same kind of concern. What do you do when there's no Jewish community? We better at least secure the cemetery's plots.
Had a number of questions come in about whether these figures that we've just discussed were supporting the cause of the revolution or the British, if you know.
Yes, we do know, and it splits. All these families split. Hayes obviously was a great patriot. I mean, he ran with Paul Revere, for heaven's sakes, and he stayed and he escaped. If he'd stayed in Newport, he could have been with the British. If he'd stayed in New York, he could have been with the British. He hightailed it to Boston and then was very devoted to building it back up after that. In New York, it went kind of down the middle. Wealthier people, as in Boston, some of them, not all, but some tended to feel that there'd be more security if the British stayed. I think we forget at the anniversary of the American Revolution that a lot of the patriots and the heroes we hear about were also a bit hooliganish. They went down and they burned John Han, Governor Hancock's house to the ground, for heaven's sake. So they weren't, the Boston Tea Party, they weren't the most inviting of people to people who had position, wealth, and property. Nevertheless, some people of wealth and property stayed, but it did split in it, like all wars, like all politics, like your Thanksgiving table, it split right down the middle.
Have some questions about relationship between Boston Jews and other cities. Were there relationships between Boston Jews and Jews who were living in other cities in America at that time because there were so few Boston Jews?
Yes, of course. And we traced the Hayes family, which spreads out. It's in Newport, it's in Boston, it's in Richmond, it's in eventually Savannah. So these families, as they marry and they move, they're the interconnected sort of genealogical relationships are very strong, and they stay very strong. And that is typical of American Jewish history in general. When the great immigrations come, a lot of the Jews that immigrate in the 1840s to 60s and then again 70s into the early 20th century go into business for themselves, which is a good way to keep your capital together. And then you hire your families, you marry into the right family. on and on that goes. That was a conscious strategy for many waves of immigrants to Jewish immigrants to America. Yes, and because, as we said in the beginning, not in Boston in the colonial period, but starting with the so-called German immigration to Boston in the 1840s to 60s, that it was equally men and women, and they were young, and so they married and they reproduced, and that reinforces a tight community and communal growth. And the fact, in fact, that 1840s to 1860s German immigration was actually Polish. So Boston not only doesn't have a Sephardic underlay, it has a very thin, true German underlay. When it gets a Jewish community, it's pretty much Eastern European from the start.
I have a question from Deborah, which is, can you speculate on what led them to make different choices, their different origins in the US, referring to these figures that you talked about?
Can I speculate? Monus is a complicated character. I know him probably as well as any historian. He read deeply. I mean, I have read virtually everything published in the 17th century, and so I've read what he's read. And he has read very deeply. And he wanted to talk about it. And there's nobody in New York to talk to about it. Can't really talk to people in Europe. That's a long conversation, long distance conversation. But there are really excellent, excellent Hebraicists in Cambridge. And so it makes sense that he would have started to talk to them. Now, whether they were intentionally trying to convert Monus, probably. Was Monus reaching that conclusion on his own? Probably. Was Monus's Hebrew excellent? Probably, because Cotton Mather, who was by all counts a brilliant Hebraicist, thought that Monus cut the grade. He's following his intellect, he's following his heart, he's following his passion. So if I'm speculating, I'd say he followed it. Hayes, on the other hand, did have some support around him. He had a Jewish wife. He had a Jewish community in New York. He had a Jewish community in Newport. And he inherited a lot of the Toros. Rabbi Toro, Toro Synagogue in Newport, that's the Toros we're talking about. And they had children who they were able to raise up. So, at least internally to that family, it was reinforced, which probably made it easier. The fact that, by all accounts, he seems to have been a really good guy, at least the good guy part, helped him connect to the first circles of Boston society. The fact that he became wealthy doesn't hurt anything.
Another perhaps speculative, but I think a broad question that may have brought a lot of people here is one from Evelyn. Why did New York have such a prominent Jewish community, but not Boston?
Yes. So let's start from the ground. The Puritans did not hate the Jews. The Puritans did not say to the Jews, you can't come here. They said that in New York, Peter Stuyvesant didn't want the Jews to enter. He said, if we let them in, we'll have to let the Lutherans and the Mohammeds in. And they appealed to the Dutch West India, East India Company, and the Dutch East India Company, which ran the New Netherlands, said to Peter Stuyvesant, let the people in. So they came. But why did they come? Because New York was an established economic port, and that is why most Jewish immigrants came. New York had excellent imports, exports with the Caribbean, with Europe, and an excellent port itself, and a larger population and more money. The hope was that Boston would be the same thing and would attract all kinds of people, perhaps including Jews. But Boston never interested the Jews who went to New York or went to Baltimore or went to Richmond or Savannah or Charleston, because any promise that Boston had as an economic hub didn't materialize. There was an initial hope, for example, that the timber would produce really large trees. The old growth forests in Europe were gone, so that the British would be able to harvest these really tall trees and use them for masts in their navy. That never quite happened. None of it ever quite happened. So economically, Boston just was not as successful or as appealing to what the Jews were looking for.
I am continuing to see some wonderful and interesting questions in our Q&A section, and I wish that we had time for all of them, but this is where we have to wrap up for now. And I just want to say thank you again to Professor Ellen Smith for sharing her scholarship with us, and to all of you in our audience for joining us this evening. And we'd also love to share with you some upcoming events that we have at the Jewish Heritage Center. So first, if you are in the area, we invite you to our in-person events that are taking place next week. The first is on August 4th. It's called Cut from the Archive, Tuba of Card Making at Lehrer House. And on August 7th, our first Jewish Heritage Center open house in our new office. And for everyone in the audience, we hope you will save the date for February 17th, 2026, and join us for a topical webinar with Dr. Michael Hoberman on his forthcoming book, Imagining Early American Jews, focused on popular interpretations of early Jewish American history, especially as they have taken shape since the 1970s, and exploring the ethnography of current day descendants of early American Jews. I would love to also invite this audience to learn more about the Weiner Family Jewish Heritage Center on our website. And while you're there, please consider making a donation to support our preservation and educational work. Thank you. As you leave this program, you will be asked to take a very brief survey. We hope you'll take a minute to fill it out, as your feedback is valuable to helping us develop further programming. Thank you again, Ellen, and we look forward to seeing you all in the audience again soon. Goodbye until next time.